This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
What is a meteorite actually made of?
That's stunned silence. Does nobody know?
I'm going to go with Chris.
Okay. Well, it depends on the meteorite. That's the main thing. So some of them are iron and just pure iron. So they're when you get one of these, they're incredibly heavy. Some of them are made of stone, and some of them are a little more unusual. But the nice thing is that by looking at what they're made of, we can work out where they come from. So the iron ones and most of the stony ones come from the asteroid belt. So they're bits of asteroid. But some of them are made of more unusual things, and we can work out that they come from Mars or the Moon. So we've actually got bits of Mars and the Moon down here on Earth from meteorites. But you have to be very, very lucky to find one of those. I think there are about 20 or so of each in the entire world. So the answer is mostly iron, bits of stone, and sometimes bits of Mars.
I think the best places to actually search for those are in the Antarctic as well.
That's right. Not because more fall there, but just because if you see a rock in Antarctica, it's a meteorite. So they send people out just walking across the ice to look for rocks.
Because in other places they call them meteor wrongs when they pick up just what is a rock. And it's a meteorite.
My favourite, there was one in Illinois in the US not so long ago that went through somebody's house and landed in his washing basket. So you can find them anywhere.
Did he have to do his washing again?
I don't know. We'll find out. I'll report back.
Should we have a question from Twitter?
Yeah, let's go for it.
This is from Astron Lofar on Twitter. They ask, what happened before the Big Bang? Starting easy there.
Can't tell you.
I believe it was a Discworld.
I think one of the things that we can say is that we really don't know and we never really will know. And one of the things about science for me is that we're always trying to make better and better models of the world we see around us so that we can understand better the world and the universe. But we also have to admit that we do have limitations. And for us to actually hold our hands up and say, we're never going to know, I think actually gives science some sort of humanity for me. It's not just trying to explain absolutely everything.
But wouldn't it be great if we could work it out?
Yeah, it would be great. But
I could disagree with Dave, although now I find myself against humanity.
You're actually a cyborg, aren't you?
Yeah. I must kill you.
Yeah, I was going to do a voice and then thought, not against Dave. It should be pointed out that the last time I was on a stage with Dave, he was in a skirt.
That's true.
Imagine now. So today is an improvement.
Has anyone actually seen him stood up?
Just boxer shorts.
But all I wanted to say was that you have to think about what the Big Bang is. And if you run backwards, what it is the point where our theories break down entirely. And this has acquired, I think, as we talk about it, as science communicators and as outreach, this mystical sense that there was something amazing that happened. You know, there was this singularity where the density of the universe was infinite. That's what the theory tells you. But it's not that at all. That's the sign that the theory is broken down. So right now we know absolutely nothing about the Big Bang because we have no theory that can describe the universe then. That doesn't mean that we're necessarily never going to have one. And it also means that we neglect signs that we have now about what that point and the time before it might have, if there was such a thing, might have been like. So, for example, we have a universe that always increases in entropy. So whenever you have a system, it tends to disorder. So this is the classic thing of if I show you a film of breaking an egg, it makes sense in our universe if I play the film forwards. But if I play the film backwards, it looks ridiculous, because you've gone from a state of disorder to a state of order as the egg sucks itself back together. You can tell that wasn't something that happened in our universe. And so for that to be true, the universe originally must have been in a really low entropy state so that we can evolve through time to the state we're in now. So that tells you, you know, whatever the theory is, I would like it to explain that. Mm-hmm. You know, so whatever existed before needs to give us an explanation for that feature of our universe. So that's one thing. I don't know what that theory is. I will never work out what that theory is. I can be sure I won't get there. But, you know, we don't know that the theory. We know our theories don't work. Somebody will come along and overturn them, and then maybe there will be a simple answer, whether it's the Discworld or something else. We wait to see.
Hopefully some of the younger members of the Jodcast Live audience will
solve the universe for us. Because we're stuck. So, as Tom Lehrer had this wonderful line about Mozart, but I feel like applying it to Einstein, which is that when Einstein was my age, he'd done most of his best work. In Tom Lehrer's case, you know, when he... I've screwed that up, never mind. You'll cut that out, right? The Lehrer line is, when Mozart was my age, he'd been dead for 3 years. It doesn't work with Einstein. Sorry, you'll cut that out, right, Stuart, if I buy you beer?
It's going on the outtakes.
We'll leave it there,
Any other questions from the audience?
I think so.
We've got a question.
I'm Jerry Stone. I'm going to take advantage of Chris. So we have these spiral galaxies and barred spirals and so forth. And yet if you take a large bowl of, say, some sort of milky type fluid and spray a line across that bowl and then start stirring it, that line will stretch into a curve like we see the barred spirals. And if you keep on stirring it, the stuff in the center has a much greater angular velocity than that on the outside, and so the line completely breaks up. So how come we do not see that, and we actually still see the spirals as spirals, when we would expect that the inner part of the galaxies would be rotating much faster than the outer part?
So this is a well-known problem in dynamics, that, you know, how do we explain spiral arms? Because if it behaved like your experiment, then indeed what you actually see if you stir very carefully is you get a winding up. So the spiral winds itself around the center. And the answer is that spiral arms don't work like that at all. They work like traffic jams on the M25. So stars enter and leave spiral arms, in the same way that cars enter and leave traffic jams. So to imagine this, imagine being on the M20... Sorry,
Chris. Can I, in fact, have a video for you?
Oh, yeah. I should explain, before we get into this, for those of you in the audience, the M25 is a big road in London. And
this is really good.
Yeah, this is it. So this is galaxy simulation using a traffic jam. So all the cars are happily going round and round. And I haven't seen this video, so something's going to happen?
Yes, basically...
Stuart, why don't you talk us through it?
So the car drivers are all just told to drive at constant speed, but you see some of them catch up with cars in front and some of them slightly get delayed behind. That then knocks on through the rest of the cars, and you get a traffic jam moving backwards around the circle. So the cars, or the stars, are all moving this way around, yet the traffic jam itself, which isn't a real thing, it's just an accumulation of stars, is moving the opposite way around. So you see they're getting really jammed at the far side now.
So cars are leaving from the front of the jam and joining in at the back, and so the jam itself moves around. So think of the jam as the spiral arm, and you've got it's a place where there are more stars. The stars at the front are moving off, and stars at the back are jamming into it. And that's the kind of wave we've got. Yeah. And you don't get this winding problem.
Right. So by analogy, the spiral arms continue, but they're not always made up of the same stars.
Correct, absolutely. And in fact, people have looked at possible, you know, it's a dodgy area and we don't have good statistics, but people have looked on the possible effects on the solar system of entering and leaving spiral arms. Because effectively, sometimes we're in a traffic jam and sometimes we're not. Thanks for the video, Stuart. That's cool.
Stuart and I actually thought about doing that ourselves here at Jodrell, out in the visitor center car park, just getting a whole bunch of cars and just driving around the circle.
Well, we've got 50 people. They're all going to be trying to leave.
This way. What did you do tonight? Oh, we made spiral arms.
Yeah. Oh, we could put light. You could put your headlights on it. It could be at night. Oh.
We'd need a helicopter to film it, though.
No, we can climb at the Link Tower. Anyway.
Turn the lights on when you hit the gem. Star formation.
Very good.
We'll stop now.
We've got to do that.
I know.
Any more questions? We have another question. We've got a question from the audience. We'll go on audience questions.
Hang on, this man has written his question out. That means it's going to be a difficult one.
No, okay. I don't think so. Phil Murphy, what is the difference between absolute and apparent brightness?
Yeah, brightness of stars and things is measured in magnitudes, one of these crazy old units that astronomers have been using for many, many years, and are really, looking at the modern way we do things, are quite silly, but they make sense to astronomers. So magnitude is a logarithmic scale, because it works on the way, the response of your eye. And the absolute magnitude is the magnitude something would have if it was at a fixed distance from the Earth. So the apparent magnitude is how bright it actually appears to us here on Earth, wherever it happens to be in the universe. But if you want to know how bright it really is, you work out how far away it is, and then you calculate how much luminosity you'd get, how bright it would be if you stuck it at 10 parsecs. And that's what gives you your absolute magnitude, your absolute brightness.
And a parsec, just for people, is about 3.2 or so light years in distance.
Yeah, it's another one of those crazy astronomy units that, yeah, are a bit silly, really.
So for instance, the sun has an absolute, an apparent magnitude of something like minus 27 or something.
That was low is good. It's like golf handicaps.
Right? Yeah. So minus numbers mean very bright. So it's got obviously a very large apparent brightness because it's in our sky and lights everything up. Its absolute magnitude is a lot less. So if you were to put it at 10 parsecs or about 30 something light years, it would look a lot dimmer, obviously. And if you want to compare different objects, then you put them at a fixed distance to see how intrinsically bright they are compared to each other.
Actually, in order to get an absolute magnitude of a star or a source, you need to compare it with a reference at the same sort of distance away, so you can actually get that value.
Sorry for the noise outside, if anyone can hear that. We're getting a bit warm in here, so we've got the door open. And that was a plane.
It's just because I am actually wearing a skirt.
There was another question from Twitter. A question from Honorary Spock, saying, when do you think people will go to Mars? Dave, when do you think people will go to Mars?
The line that I use in the planetarium is that we're hoping to get men on Mars, or women, indeed, in the 2030s. So anyone at school at the moment could be going to Mars. I'm looking at you, children. that's the line I usually take.
Chris, would you like to go to Mars?
I'd go. The problem is that the question isn't when can we get people to Mars, because the hard bit is getting them back. I met a NASA engineer with a plan when I was last in Houston at the Johnson Space Center down there, and he thinks he can get a Mars mission for a 20th of the cost anyone else in NASA thinks. But there's a catch. And the slogan for his project, because he's got a brochure and he's trying to get NASA to sign on, is the slogan is one man, one vision, one way. And you send somebody, he's thought it through. You go there, that you've got enough stuff to keep you alive for 2 years. And every 2 years, which is, you get a good launching opportunity for Mars every 2 years, you send another ship with either somebody else or some supplies. So you can stay alive on Mars. You just don't ever get to come home. And I'd go.
I'm not sure.
He's got a long list of people signed up.
I'm not sure I'd like to rely on the funding situation back on Earth to keep you alive in food.
Yeah, I would want access to Twitter as well. I don't think I could exist without Twitter. But apart from that...
I read a book once.
Did you?
Yes.
This is before the internet?
Yes. Yeah, they had these things called books, you know, in big libraries. And it was by a Russian author. And he had worked out the chemistry and the logistics of sending people to Mars quite some time ago, which followed the similar kind of model. You sent off a rocket first with the equipment required to produce water and oxygen on the surface of Mars by itself automatically. Then you arrive and step into your nicely warm and oxygenated home on Mars, and you could have this sort of shuttle system, a cycle of people coming and going quite well. And the strongest point I remember this author making was that the technology existed well back in the time. It was just a matter of dedicating yourself to doing it.
Yeah.
And going ahead. You didn't need particularly... technology which had not been developed.
Well, there are two technological problems. One is surviving radiation on the way there, which you can think up some solutions to. The other is landing a large thing on Mars is a problem that hasn't been solved yet. On the moon, you've got no atmosphere, so you can use rockets. It works very well. On the Earth, you've got a thick atmosphere, so you can come down like the Apollo astronauts did with parachutes, or with a heat shield and then parachutes. On Mars, neither quite works. There's a thin atmosphere, but it's not thick enough to... It's thick enough to prevent you doing a lunar-type landing, and it's too thin to allow you to land like the Apollo astronauts did. So that's the major technological hurdle, is getting down. It's whether we want to do it. Because the question, which we're not answering, was when, right? Yeah. And I'm, you know, up 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, you can hit whatever timescale you want, I think, for Mars. 10 years is a minimum. If you say now you're going to do it and you put the money aside now. But, you know, if you asked any one of us in our day jobs what we'd spend $50 billion on, I suspect that you wouldn't get a single manned mission, because for any given scientific return, you can make a lot of hay out of robots and robotic probes. It's all the extras that come with manned spaceflight. So there are all sorts of issues here, and now I'm wittering.
But, and of course, we know what happens to the first base on Mars anyway, so it all ends badly.
There's actually quite a worrying statistic as well. I think it's about only 2/3 of the total number of missions which have been led for Mars have been successful. So there's
just
a third
over
of them.
Half.
Is it just over half? See, I mean, there's that human factor of risk that you need to take into account, whether you actually want to take it and say, you could die, you've got a 50-50 chance.
I'd still go. Amazing. Would you? How many of the panel would go? 50-50 odds and you don't get to get come home. Anyone?
I'd have to pay to...
You'd have to pay, no.
One thing that the European Space Agency is doing is, quite recently, they asked for volunteers to be locked up for, I think, over 500 days to see what happens to people, what would happen to them on the way to Mars, because that's about how long it would take to get there.
And we know there's always going to be someone who goes insane and tries to kill the rest of the crew.
I mean, otherwise
we know that
be a
from
good
sci-fi,
movie.
Yeah. Right?
Sounds like doing a PhD at George Washington.
You guys ever seen the movie Moon?
Yes. Oh, that's fantastic.
Oh, that would be really interesting, yeah. Because you're saying like that Mars Direct sort of mission. So, I mean, imagine getting a load of clones, right? You send them in a spaceship over there. There's nothing about it. And, what's your uncle?
It would be just like the Jodcast. Those of you at home won't realise that all the panel look identical.
No, Stuart is in a black T-shirt, not a blue one.
Being different.
Anyway. I just love the idea of Mars Direct. It sounds like some sort of mail order company. Mail order chocolate company.
That's weird.
Any other questions from the audience?
Hang on, this is a professional.
So we now have Paul Miyagawa from CERN, who's about to ask us a question, hopefully not about what he does.
No, it wouldn't be that mean. Okay, my question is fairly prosaic, I guess. It's more planetary rather than stellar-based, but I mean, the Earth's axis of rotation is close to perpendicular to its plane of orbit, and I think there's one planet that has its axis of rotation in line with its orbit. Why do these differences come up, and which is more stable, or is either one inherently more stable?
Nick?
I'll have a crack at this one. I taught basic astronomy. Yeah. Eh?
You say I taught, I saw it.
There are these pre-programmed landmines when you're talking for entertainment.
Is that the time?
Beer o'clock.
All right. Yes, from what I recall, there are some theories as to why some planets have a very tipped over rotation axis compared to its the plane of its orbit. And that is to do with the formation of the planets in the solar system from the protoplanetary cloud. And the wrong way of thinking about how planets formed is in a very calm, relaxed environment where a little bit of gas over here forms into a planet and a little bit of gas over there forms into a planet. The theory is that lots of gas formed into lots of little bits and pieces, planetesimals, and then they hit each other for a long time. And as time goes on, those things which are hitting each other get bigger and bigger and bigger until some of them coalesce into planets themselves, and some of them are left alone for the remainder of their lives, more or less. But as that coalescence proceeds, those things which are coalescing get bigger and bigger and bigger, and you can imagine the point where one protoplanetary blob of stuff gets hit by something which is roughly the same size as it and gets smacked over. So you end up with also a range of rotation axes with respect to the orbital plane. I think that's...
That sounds pretty good. The two problem children of the solar system are Uranus and Venus. So Uranus, the tilt's 98 degrees, so it's just past on its side, and Venus is backwards. So it rotates in the opposite direction to everything else, almost 180. The idea is that these are the results of collisions in the early solar system, which sounds vaguely plausible. I think as we're beginning to see similar effects in protoplanetary disks. Now we can see them directly. We've seen there's a fantastic result a few months ago, which detected essentially the leftovers from a collision within a disk. It was silica in glass form, essentially. So the idea is that this is the result of bashing stuff together and melting it. So we see these processes happening. The other part of your question was about which is more stable. I think once the disk has gone away, I don't think it makes any difference at all. And you've then got your locked in, barring a bizarre large
huge collision.
Yeah, you've got locked in axes. The early solar system being dynamic is interesting because I hadn't realized the theory is that Uranus and Neptune have swapped places several times in the early solar system, because Saturn starts off in the wrong place. Jupiter and Saturn both move and interact, and every time Saturn comes out, it forces Uranus and Neptune to swap places. And the computer simulations show this ridiculously dynamic early solar system that settles down into the one we've got today. So it's the result of quite a chaotic formation process, just like the Jodcast.
But are we going to suddenly flip our direction of rotation? But it's true, though, and it was quite chaotic. And I mean, there was some work on the Earth-Moon system a while ago, which showed, well, these guys got into their computer, wrote some code, and found that the system was actually chaotic, meaning that all of a sudden, if you took away the moon, the Earth rotation axis could flip quite dramatically during its time. And that's quite disturbing to think about that. But
Mars wobbles as well. Yeah. We know the idea is climate cycles on Mars are linked to the wobble of the axis. So you might have had times when Mars had seasons, and you might have had times when Mars didn't, and that affects what happens to the ice and whether there's water on the surface and all sorts of things.
And there's a connection with habitability of planets too, because Earth is odd in that it's got a very large moon compared to its size, as most of you probably know. But that's got an effect on its dynamics in that it stabilizes the rotation axis for a significant period of the planet's life. So having a planet that doesn't all of a sudden go spin, oh, I want to spin that way now, is probably quite good for evolving life. So one theory is that in order to find a planet which is suitable for life, as we know it, Jim, is to demand that it has a relatively large moon, which is an interesting thing, which I'll stop talking about now.
Okay, thank you very much, and thank you to the panel. And to the audience, indeed, for your questions, and over on Twitter and Ustream. Thank you.